Hello, and thank you for downloading Witness from the BBC World Service. Today we take you back more than 80 years to focus on one of the defining episodes in Mahatma Gandhi's struggle to end British rule in India. Alan Johnston reports.
It's early April 1930, and a band of protesters is making its way slowly through the fields and villages of Gujarat in western India. Striding out in front in his white cotton robes is Mahatma Gandhi. He's marching to the coast where he intends to make salt from the sea. He will defy British-imposed laws on the production and taxation of this vital substance.
He realized that salt mattered a lot to the people of India.
Tushar Gandhi is Mahatma Gandhi's great-grandson.
Poverty was such that many people were reduced to eating a dry bread with just a pinch of salt. And the British, in all their wisdom, had turned that into a monopoly. And so Mahatma Gandhi realized that next to air and water, in our climate, salt was the thing that was essential for life. And it would affect the poorest of the poor and the weakest of the weak.
In 2005, on the 75th anniversary of the Salt March, Tushar Gandhi retraced its route, following in the footsteps of his great-grandfather, or Bapu, as he calls him.
People from the villages we were passing through would be lined up on both sides of the street, offering us water and milk and all sorts of refreshing drinks and things to eat. And I think in the 30s it would have been even more so. And with the aura of Bapu at that time, it must have been quite a sight. It must have been, if I was there, most probably I would have been up on a tree trying to catch the first glimpse of the saint walking towards my village.
And there would have been musicians and drumming and singing and a huge entourage.
Oh yes. Even when we went, every town had their own band and orchestra, and they were all lined up and making a huge big racket to welcome us. And I'm sure that is what was happening at that time too.
As the Mahatma's march went on, it attracted national and even international attention. And after more than 3 weeks on the road, Gandhi and his thousands of followers arrived at a village called Dandi on the Arabian Sea.
When the seawater receded, it used to get caught in small pools and depressions and would evaporate and then leave behind a crust of salt on the mud, which would glitter in the sunlight, glittering like diamonds. And they thought that that would be the easiest way to pick up the salt. When the English finally realized what was hitting them, the kind of public opinion that was being created. So in the last 3 days before Bapu reached Dandi, they ploughed the entire marsh, you know, mixed the crust, salt crust, into the mud. So when Bapu reached there, there was no salt to pick up. It was all freshly churned up mud. And the British said, okay, you want to have a mud bath? You're welcome to have one. But Bapu was not going to be defeated. He knew that the mud also had salt in it. And he wasn't after quantities. He wasn't going to tell the British that I'm going to produce a ton of salt and then defy you. He was happy even if he managed to get a grain of salt. And that fistful of mud that he picked up and showed to the world in a raised fist, his followers then distilled it and evaporated the water and got about 10 ounces of salt from that fistful of mud that Bapu had picked up. And at that time, a businessman from Ahmedabad bought that 10 ounces of salt for about 1,000 odd rupees. And that was the defiance that Bapu made. That then triggered a whole action of salt making throughout India, throughout the subcontinent. And the British tales were really salted on that day.
Mahatma Gandhi was arrested, but his supporters pressed on with the campaign. They remained utterly committed to their leader's philosophy of non-violence, and an American journalist named Webb Miller would witness this. He was looking on as Gandhi's followers tried to raid a salt works, which was heavily defended by police at a place called Dharasana.
The police carried lathis, 5-foot clubs tipped with steel. In complete silence, the Gandhi men drew up and halted 100 yards from the stockade. Police officials ordered the marchers to disperse. The column silently ignored the warning and slowly walked forward. Suddenly, at a word of command, scores of native police rushed upon the advancing marchers and rained blows on their heads with steel-shod lathis. Not one of the marchers even raised an arm to fend off the blows. They went down like tenpins. From where I stood, I heard the sickening wax of the clubs on unprotected skulls. The waiting crowd of watchers groaned and sucked in their breaths in sympathetic pain at every blow. Those struck down fell sprawling, unconscious, or writhing in pain, with fractured skulls or broken shoulders. In 2 or 3 minutes, the ground was quilted with bodies. Great patches of blood widened on their white clothes. When every one of the first column had been knocked down, stretcher-bearers rushed up and carried off the injured to a thatched hut which had been arranged as a temporary hospital. Then another column formed, while the leaders pleaded with them to retain their self-control. They marched slowly towards the police. Although everyone knew that within a few minutes they would be beaten down, perhaps killed, I could detect no signs of wavering or fear. They marched steadily, with heads up, without the encouragement of music or cheering or any possibility that they might escape serious injury or death. The police rushed out and methodically and mechanically beat down the second column. There was no fight, no struggle. The marchers simply walked forward until struck down. There were no outcries, only groans after they fell. There were not enough stretcher-bearers to carry off the wounded. I saw 18 injured being carried off simultaneously, while 42 still lay bleeding on the ground, awaiting stretcher-bearers. The blankets used as stretchers were sodden with blood.
Mahatma Gandhi's son, Manilal, who was Tushar Gandhi's grandfather, was among those who were beaten.
The wounded would be whisked away and put in prisons and then sent to prison hospitals, and the relatives had to go looking for them and try to find them. So for a week they didn't know where my grandfather was, and my grandmother used to always narrate that story, and even after so many years had passed and she was just narrating the story, I could see the anxiety on her face and hear it in her voice, because it must have been pretty harrowing in those days, not knowing whether, you know, you still had a husband or not.
The campaign in 1930 failed to bring an end to the British taxes on salt, and it would be another 17 years before India would gain its independence. But Tushar Gandhi has no doubt that his great-grandfather's march to the sea was very significant. After it, the British knew that they could be overwhelmed by non-violent mass civil disobedience.
They realized that no matter what they did, these Indians, in their own unique ways, were going to thumb their noses at them and say, we are not going to be cowed down. And that is what finally defeated the empire. It became more and more difficult for the British to justify their rule of India.
Tushar Gandhi ending that edition of Witness, which was written and presented by Alan Johnston. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.